The history of television is a history of failure.
For every television series that lasted years and years, there were dozens that lasted only one season or less.
But did they deserve to die? Or were they canceled too soon? Everybody, and welcome back to Canceled Too Soon, the podcast where we review television shows that lasted only one season or less. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
Indeed.
Yeah, thought I'd give you some suspense, but then I thought about maybe switching up my nickname. We've done 225 episodes with this nickname. Maybe time to change a new one. Nope. I am set in my ways. I am old, old, old. Whitney, who are you?
My name is Whitney Seibold. I've been old this whole time.
Nice.
I'm not. I was about to say I'm not any older, but I guess I am older. I'm older every second.
Older, wiser.
And we've all aged quite a bit since our last episode.
Yeah. So we announced that we were back on track, and then Whitney was like, no. And so that's fine.
Whitney started a 9-to-5 job, and it's... Yeah.
Well, we thought that would make her schedule easier. It turns out, no.
No, it turns out it's just a big old monkey wrench.
We're still figuring it out. We're still adjusting to a new paradigm over here, but we have been keeping Canceled Too Soon in our thoughts, and Lord knows we've been very eager to get to our 225th episode, and one of our most requested shows ever, like right from the first episode. This was not the number one, but this is like the number 4, 5, 6, right up there.
When we started this show, it was still relatively fresh in people's minds.
Yes, that's true. But regardless, it is finally time, in this very special anniversary episode, to review Terriers.
What kind of cases do you take on?
My partner and I do any number of things.
Do you have a pool needs cleaning?
Do not have a pool.
We recover lost property. Locate people. We'll jump down, turn around, pick a bale of cotton if you pay us enough.
Keep the pressure on. Are you keeping the pressure on?
Yes, I am keeping the pressure on.
Do you ever handle domestic cases?
What do I have to do?
Get laid.
Marital infidelities, things like that.
Happens to be one of our specialties.
Who wants to watch?
What's wrong?
This thing's a lot more complicated than I thought.
I need you to do this.
Do what exactly?
What have you done with my husband?
Look, I don't know the woman, man. I don't know why she'd make up something like that.
I'm so scared.
Help! Help! Jesus, God, I hope you have a plan.
It is one of between this one and Perpetual Grace Limited or Perpetual Grace. Those two have like the most catchy theme songs.
They're very chill, but they're very catchy. Like you will not.
After Perpetual Grace was like, sometimes you'll ride on a comet, and this one is riding down to the beach with a javelin man.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure what that means. I guess you're gonna go harpooning. Yeah.
The title of the theme song is Gunfight Epiphany, and it was written by, let me look it up, Robert Duncan. Not to be confused with Robert Duncan McNeil, who played Tom Paris on Star Trek Voyager.
Oh, I'm going to confuse them all day long. Thank you very much.
Robert Duncan did the music for a lot of TV shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Castle and The Unit and Lie to Me.
Very successful at what he does.
Prolific composer. And this show was created... one of the executive producers was Tim Minear. Tim Minear, who worked on Buffy the Vampire Slayer and notably Firefly.
Yeah, but it was created by screenwriter Ted Griffin, who's probably best known for writing the screenplay or co-writing the screenplay to Steven Soderbergh's Ocean's 11 remake, which is very fondly remembered. It was a huge hit when it came out. He's also been attached to a lot of movies, some good, some bad. Let's see here. He did Matchstick Men, the Ridley Scott con artist movie. He did Ravenous, which is one of the better horror movies of the 90s. He wrote Rumor Has It, the Jennifer Aniston movie, where it's like she kind of marries into the family from The Graduate, something like that.
Yeah.
Is that what that was about?
It's like, this vague follow-up to The Graduate.
Yeah. And also the Brett Ratner film Tower Heist and many other things. Also, one of the head writers on the show who worked on every episode, Leslie Headland. who is best known nowadays for doing the Netflix series Russian Doll, but she's also executive producing, spearheading one of the upcoming Star Wars TV series over on Disney Plus. So a lot of really big talented people behind the scenes of Terriers and in front of the scenes.
The show stars Donald Logue, and I love Donald Logue.
Yeah.
He's... I forgot where I first saw him.
For me, it was The Tao of Steve.
Yeah, it was in this indie film in 2000 called The Tao of Steve.
The Tao of Steve starred Donald Logue as, you know, just a kind of a Big Lebowski-ish kind of guy, kind mm-hmm. of a shiftless layabout, you know, fat. But the idea was that even though he didn't have a good career, even though he wasn't conventionally attractive, and a lot of the movie is about how he is fat, but... he's still incredibly successful with women, and the idea is he's got a good philosophy mm-hmm. on how to approach dating and life. And over the course of the film, he realizes that that philosophy is incredibly immature. I haven't rewatched it in forever. I have no idea if it holds up. I remember it being considered pretty good for its time. But for all I know, it's the technical politics of age.
I remember where I saw him first. Yeah. He was Gunter Janik in Sneakers.
Oh my God, that's right. Where I saw him first. Absolutely.
He was this like... this mathematician who was just sort of like spouting a lot of mathematics.
He's
nonsense.
Kind of the most important character in the movie, but he's barely in it.
Yeah.
So that's a good point.
The character, a lot of the main characters are following.
I wonder what his first role is. I'm going to look this up right now. Ooh, he's in 158 things. Anyway,
he was in a really wonderful sitcom that didn't last very long. It was a mid-season replacement on Fox called Grounded for Life.
Yeah,
that one was pretty good.
It didn't get canceled too soon. Some would argue that it did. It didn't get canceled after one season.
Five seasons.
But it was always barely scraping on. Somehow this movie managed to not die on the vine. Looks like his first movie as an actor credited was a lot of TV. Oh shit, that was Sneakers.
Sneakers was his first movie.
It was his first feature film. He did the set, and 1 year later he did Three Ninjas Knuckle Up. bit of a shift in quality there. But he did a lot of TV before that.
He's done a lot of TV. He's done a lot of movies. He was in, you know, he's been in some high profile stuff.
He played Harvey Bullock in Gotham, which was good casting.
He was one of Stephen Dorff's vampire minions in the movie Blade.
Oh, that's right.
He got his arm cut off, and he like showed off that he was growing one back, but it wasn't whole yet. It's like, I got a new arm, man. And then Stephen Dorff says, "Hey, hold out your arm, and we'd use this sword to cut it off." It's like, "Oh, come on, man, don't do that." Oh, fine. Donald Logue is an unbelievably charming actor. He's very, very good. He's really well suited to the role he plays in Terriers, which is an ex police officer, unlicensed private detective, recovering alcoholic named Hank Dulworth.
He does working class really well. Mm-hmm. Like the idea is, he's very talented, but he is absolutely never going to be rich. He's always going to be just barely struggling by. Mm. And his partner is an ex-con turned unlicensed private investigator. Britt Pollock, played by Michael Raymond James. At the time, he was probably best known for True Blood, where he had had a recurring role. But nowadays, I think he might be best known for Terriers. Because he's wonderful in this show. He's really, really great. And they got a really great, easygoing, laid-back dynamic. Of all the shows about partners, you know, like The X-Files or NYPD Blue or et cetera like that, you just want to have a really solid rapport between your leads, whether it's antagonistic or conflicting or just these guys are actually really good together. They're good friends. You want to be on a stakeout with them.
Yeah, there's this magic thing that certain actors have together. Sometimes great actors don't even have this, but this idea that they were friends before they met that morning on set.
Yeah.
You know, you understand that they actually have sort of an established relationship, and Michael Raymond James and Donald Logue have that.
Yeah.
The show, Terriers, it's ostensibly a crime investigation show. It's about their private investigation, but 52% of the show is actually devoted to their personal lives.
Yeah.
Like, this is more of soap opera than it is a cop show.
It's not a procedural. It's got a lot of television shows that we've seen here on Cancel Too Soon are, they have an episodic concept. We are lawyers, every week we have a new case. We are doctors, every week we have a new case.
But there's ongoing dramas with the characters that are going to last throughout the show.
Yeah, and Terry's is kind of set up that way too, except sometimes they don't bother doing a new case this week. Sometimes it's just about their family drama. Sometimes it's just about their romantic relationships. Sometimes we go into the past and just see where they came from. And sometimes we do get into this overarching story where in between somewhat typical, at least on the surface, private detective cases about investigating if someone's cheating on their husband or finding a missing item, etc. They also, in the pilot, fall into what at first seems like a pretty nasty just murder cover-up, and then they realize it's just the tip of the iceberg and there's actually a major sort of real estate conspiracy going on this fictional town, which is...
No, it's San Diego.
It's San Diego, but they're also like kind of in like a fictional like suburb of it.
Yeah, there's like this, I think they call it like Oceanside or Ocean Beach. Yeah. And it's this fictional neighborhood within San Diego, but it's also San Diego.
It's mostly filmed in San Diego. Some of it I've seen like was filmed like, okay, that looks like Venice Beach, but mostly it seems to be filmed in San Diego.
There's several scenes in Balboa Park, which is in San Diego. I go there frequently.
There is there's a party that is thrown about two-thirds of the way through the show. For Donald Logue's ex-wife, who is getting remarried, and they're having like an engagement party, and it's on the roof of a hotel where I have been to more Comic-Con parties than I can count. And you can see the Comic-Con, like the San Diego Convention Center, like right in the background. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, oh, that's where I took a picture with Doctor Who. I met Bill Paxton there. That's really kind of fun. So it's they really do get a lot of local details pretty close to right.
Hank Dolworth, like I said, recovering alcoholic, and there's a lot of flashbacks in this show. In fact, the second to last episode, the 12th one, is pretty much all flashback.
Yeah.
And we get to see how Hank Dolworth...
Lost his job.
Was not just lost his job as a cop, but was alienated from his longtime partner.
Yeah.
Who is played by, let me look up him.
You got it. You can do it. I believe in you. I'd look it up, but I believe in you too much.
Detective Mark Gustafson, played by Rockmond Dunbar.
Ah, yes.
Rockmond Dunbar. What a great name.
What an amazing name.
He's sort of like the cop who is always sort of butting into the case early in the series, and it's not until a little bit later that we learn that he's actually Hank's ex-partner.
Yeah. I think they talk about it a little bit, but it's never clear how deep their relationship was.
Yeah, like
they clearly had a past. Yeah. And there's a bit where he's talking to Brett. It's like, keep an eye out for this guy. He will let you down.
Yeah,
so they definitely have something going on.
And his shtick is he's always chewing on something. He's got like a cigar or a toothpick.
Yeah. Meanwhile, they also have Britt has a girlfriend named Katie, played by Laura Allen. She is studying to be a veterinarian. I love their relationship for most of the show, actually.
Because they're really into each other.
It's not just that they're really into each other, but they're actually really open with each other, and she knows about his criminal past. And there's a great bit later on where he thinks there's like one thing about his past he never told her. And he's like, this is going to be the thing that ruins our relationship. I have to keep this a secret. And then when he finally just buckles down and takes people's advice and just tells her, she's like, that is horrible. I want you to get out right now. And then I want you to come back in 5 minutes and tear my clothes off.
Yeah,
because they're good together.
I appreciate, actually, the amount of emotional honesty in Terriers.
Yeah.
It seems like at the start, and I was a little taken aback when they started shifting gears in the second episode, because the first one is all procedural. It's just, we're going to go to this beach house and confront this rich guy, and we find a dead body in a lifeguard station.
Yeah, we need to prove we can do the private detective genre right, so they do in the pilot. Yeah.
So yeah, the pilot is pretty much all private detective stuff, and we set up some like background character stuff, and then in the second episode, it's focusing more on their emotional honesty and how open they are and how kind of wounded they've been.
Kind of establishing that there's going to be a through line with this conspiracy. Mm. But yeah, it takes a real step back and makes it real chill. Meanwhile, we've also got Donald Logue's ex-wife, Gretchen, played by Kimberly Quinn.
Kimberly Quinn, and she's getting remarried.
To Lauren Dean. Remember when Lauren Dean was a thing?
He was going to be big for a second
He was in Mumford.
I like the film Mumford.
Before he had sons, there was this movie called Mumford.
Oh my god.
And Mumford's actually a cute film. It's about a guy who moves to a small town and he's a psychiatrist.
And the town is called Mumford.
Yeah.
His real name is actually Mumford.
So he's Mumford, he moves to Mumford.
But he's also a con man.
Well, he's a con man, but he's not like... He's just conning he's conning people into thinking he's a psychologist. He's not trying to con him out of money or anything like that. He's just pretending to be a psychologist, and he's trying to be a good psychologist. And it turns out, even though he doesn't have training, he just listens well, and everyone starts to really like him. And they're because he's so nice and so good to everybody, they ignore all the red flags that he's clearly not really a psychologist. Yeah. There's like this
He finally confides in one of his patients, played by Jason Lee. Right? Yeah. Remember when Jason Lee was going to be a big thing. And,
Well, Jason Lee was a big thing. My Name is Earl was a huge sitcom for a while.
Apologies.
Yeah. Jason Lee made big on TV.
Jason Lee did fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, he confides in Jason Lee. It's like, I'm not really a shrink. And also, I'm in love with one of my patients. And Jason Lee's like, oh, wow. That's like a... It's not me, is it? No, it's not you. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Well,
Yeah,
I guess it'd be worse if you were a shrink and you were in love with one of your patients.
Yeah.
Like, this makes it not so bad.
So, yeah, that's Lauren Dean.
That's
and,
a cute film. Just watch it.
A big plot with Hank and Lauren Dean is, you know, Hank is not over him being dumped.
Yeah.
He doesn't like that he was divorced. And, in fact, there's a big plot about how he's trying to buy the house that he and his wife shared.
Which I love the bit where he's got, because a lot of like the first few episodes is him trying to make enough money to put a down payment on the house that he and his wife shared. This is the house where he was a completely raging alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes to an AA meeting and everyone's like, this is the stupidest thing you could do. This is absolutely going to trigger your alcoholism. Mm-hmm. You need to not have a constant reminder of your alcoholic past and your divorce. And he keeps doing it anyway because it just means so much to him.
Yeah.
He can't let go.
And additionally, he starts, because he's a private investigating, starts looking into Lauren Dean's past.
Yeah.
The character is named Jason. And
it turns out he's actually got a pretty weird and disturbing past.
Yeah, he's got like a lot of like shadows and skeletons in his closet, and it's really, really kind of horrifying. And again, in another wave of emotional honesty that this show has, he's going, and this lasts for like maybe three of the episodes. We're not going episode by episode because a lot of it is just a grand arc as to what happens.
Yeah, it's a little hard to do.
There's like a two episodes where he's investigating Lauren Dean.
Yeah, and at first it seems like he's fine, you know? He's kind of a dweeb, but he's okay.
Hank Dolworth starts finding all of these like little things in his past that seem a little bit suspicious. He digs deeper and finds some criminal stuff.
Well, yeah.
Like legitimately weird criminal stuff.
Legitimately disturbing. Yeah. It turns out that his family was implicated in a horrible series of sex crimes that were never entirely proven, and he was a minor at the time. So he is concerned that, you know, here's someone who might have a history of sexual violence. And he tries to tell his ex-wife that, and she's like, he told me that.
He
was innocent of it. He was young, too. He was also,
she said, he told me that on the second date.
And yeah, so, like, this whole thing that you thought he was keeping from me.
Standing there with egg on his face.
Yeah, and so he's just like, emotional honesty. Mm. Oh, we should have had that. Yeah. And granted, that's still a really dark subplot. And it's the sort of thing where I'm really surprised that she's that gung-ho about it. But then again, we really don't get to see that first revelation or how she dealt with that and what kind of conversations that they had. She looked into it.
Yeah, and
you know? So if you trust her intelligence and her emotional intelligence...
Gretchen.
If you trust Gretchen's intelligence and emotional intelligence, and we see no reason not to, you want to believe her. But he's also, like, that's a huge deal.
Yeah.
That's huge.
And so there's, like, a little bit... Like, I feel like Gretchen is dealing with this in a very adult fashion.
Yeah, she's trying to.
And it's Hank Dolworth who has a lot of growing up to do. Because he's damaged himself by years of addiction and violence and just not treating his job very well and just kind of falling to pot. Now he's kind of like using this private investigation to get back on his feet.
And really, that's character writing 101, but in the good way. It's you have someone who is really good at something, in this case, being a private detective or a detective. And that has made him really bad at something else. So you can see him in the driver's seat, pushing the story forward, being confident, cool, fun, sexy even. And you also see him at his absolute worst with a lot to learn. And you see this in most of the great characters, everyone from Sherlock Holmes to Rocky. You know, it's basically, he may be good at one thing, but his life is a shambles.
Yeah.
And that's why, Donald Logue knows how to play that.
Yeah.
He's been playing some variation on that most of his career.
Like intense and intelligent sad sacks.
Yeah. Intelligent sad sacks are to Donald Logue what any Shakespeare character is to Kenneth Branagh. You just know if he's in that role, the role will be fine. He knows what to do with that.
Ooh, what Shakespearean role would be good for Donald Logue? Falstaff.
Falstaff.
Kind of like the easy one.
That's the obvious. Okay, fine. We'll take Falstaff out of it. It's too obvious.
Yeah. Apart from Falstaff.
Who's like, and you gotta think of him now, because he's an older guy now. He's never gonna play Romeo or something like that now. So who
Donald Logue is?
He would the jester in King Lear.
Oh, there you go. The fool.
The fool. I think he'd be a really good fool in King Lear. Because the fool in King Lear is, like many fools in Shakespeare, actually rather intelligent and insightful.
Yeah.
And that could be cool.
And is really bitter about everything.
Yeah, I'd buy that. Yeah. I think it'd be cool.
To mirror Hank, we have Britt Pollock's subplot.
Mm, yeah.
And this is, like, straight up soap opera 101 story beats. And I think they play it well, but it is kind of predictable.
Because what happens is
Katie, the Lauren Allen character, is studying to be a vet.
Yeah, and she's a little older, going to college with a lot of younger people. Mm-hmm. They're getting started on that journey.
But she's about 30.
She's in her 30s. When I was in college, we had like some people who were like 10 years older than everyone else. Yeah, and it's fine, but I'm sure the experience is very different for them. Mm-hmm. So she's constantly being invited by her classmates and her teachers to various school functions, and she's not going because she's older and has other stuff to do. And in about halfway through the season, Britt even encourages, hey, go hang out with your friends, be cool. And then she gets drunk and almost has sex with one of her classmates, and instead has sex with her teacher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she wakes up, in her professor's bed. She's like, oh,
yeah, she's horrified. Yeah, horrified. And initially, we don't see that. We don't see, like, the seduction or is it worse? And initially I'm like, oh God, was she drugged? Yeah, was she
taken,
like,
advantage of?
Yeah, was she taken advantage of? And then the startling thing and the disturbing thing, for the character, obviously, that would be much more disturbing if she was assaulted. But, the unexpected thing is that she actually just says, I was drunk, but I knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
And I was just frightened of commitment. I knew he was interested in commitment than I was, and I didn't think I deserved him, and I sabotaged the relationship, and I felt really bad about it immediately afterwards. And then, of course, obviously she gets pregnant, and she doesn't know whose it is.
Which, again, that's soap opera stuff. That's, you have sex once and you're pregnant.
That's a little tired. It happens, but like, the odds are pretty slim.
It can, yes, but it happens so often in movies, it becomes a plot contrivance.
Exactly, and that's not usually how that works.
And, but I appreciate Laura Allen's performance. She's really good sort of selling these kind of cliched moments. And I kind of appreciate the way it played out, because she tells Hank first. Mm-hmm. She's like,
it's almost like in Seven, when Gwyneth Paltrow was telling Morgan Freeman, I'm pregnant and I don't know if I want to keep it. Mm-hmm. And he has a long conversation with her about, if you make this decision, you might be on your own, Andy. You might not want to tell him. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing, and
So she's got this on her chest, and she has to get it off her chest, and she tells Hank, and Hank, in a rather diplomatic way, says, "Keep it a secret."
Yeah,
and he's not like, "Oh no, if you tell him, he'll explode and he'll kill somebody, and there's something at stake."
It'll hurt his feelings.
It'll just hurt him, and if you care about
the relationship, but this is really the only time this is ever going to happen.
If you tell him and this is like clearly an aberration, then just don't tell him and you'll be okay.
There's a lot of movies and TV shows that struggle with the morality of honesty regarding infidelity. And of course, we're assuming we're not in like a polio relationship where people would be fine with this, but it actually would be considered a betrayal. I have seen shows where the idea is honesty is always the most important thing. It will hurt, but we'll get through this. Mm. I think it was like Sex and the City talked once about like, is it more selfish to give myself a catharsis and hurt their feelings?
Yeah.
Because this would never happen again. This was my mistake. Mm-hmm. And it shouldn't have to hurt them. And maybe we'd be better if I just kept it to myself. And that was my penance, was that this is something I have to like just endure alone. Mm-hmm. There's not great answers to that, honestly. Yeah. Like, I would personally, I'm of the school of honesty is the best policy. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, at best, you're going to live with resentments and all kinds of shit. So
I've seen a lot of stories. Yeah. That sort of, I'm going to tell them, or they find out in some way.
Yeah.
There aren't a lot of stories about, I kept it a secret and we were happy for 50 years after.
Yeah. The only one I can think of, it's not quite the same thing, but I was thinking of, and of course the filmmaker is, Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Oh, there you go.
Where, like, a big part of the story, there's a guy who overthinks every single moral decision in his life as a shambles, and then there's another guy who is cheating on his wife, and she gets pregnant, and he has her murdered, and he's fine
and
with it.
And he gets away with it, and he's fine with it. No moral problems.
And so it's all a matter of how much you worry about it, really. And you think about the context of the filmmaker, Woody Allen. That's kind of a really gross storyline,
yeah.
But
well, there's that's also the plot of Match Point, another Woody Allen.
Another one, So
you're,
a lot of red flags.
Start to wonder a little thing, more than you're already wondering about Woody Allen.
Yeah, right.
But that story plays itself out because eventually she can't handle the guilt. She's just, she feels completely horrible about it.
Because they go to Gretchen's wedding and it's just full of reminders. Mm. And she starts noticing that she might be pregnant. Mm. And he starts pushing because he's excited about it.
Well, and he notices she's pregnant because she threw away a pregnancy test and he finds it in the trash.
It's such a dude thing, though, to assume that she was pregnant. I mean, the fact that she's not telling you might mean she wasn't. And it was a false scare. And why would you make the assumption? And of course, he runs out and buys a ring because he loves her and he was going to do it anyway. Mm. And yeah, it all comes out real bad. Yeah. Real bad.
And I appreciate, though, that it came out and they're both completely devastated by the revelation.
Yeah, there's like two episodes where they're just miserable.
But they continue to communicate. Yeah. And not in a painful way where they're just sort of screaming at each other about,
They're sad and it's not
they're,
happy.
They're
like,
sad there's betrayal and they're hurt. But at the same time, they both realize that the relationship can still exist. Mm-hmm. So I think that's maybe a little bit more of a mature view than of infidelity than we get in a lot of stories.
I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of the relationship skill that we got, and again, this is all a collaborative medium. The actors are influencing. Ted Griffin, I'm sure, does a lot of it. But knowing that Leslie Headland worked on all these episodes goes a long way to my thinking that she might have had something to do with how rich and nuanced the relationships are. She's a really great screenwriter. She did that remake of a remake of About Last Night
Michael Ealy.
Michael Ealy, thank you. I was gonna say Almost Human. Yeah, Michael Ealy, because he was in that show, Almost Human. And that's a really, really great remake. It's a really lot of good relationship stuff in there. And also Sleeping with Other People, which is one of my favorite rom-coms the last decade.
We've been to her house.
She was nice. It was like a rental or something, whatever.
It was like a temporary home.
It's one of my great regrets. We did an episode of a podcast with her, and we were talking about like the greatest romantic comedies of all time. It was really wonderful. It was really insightful. And then I go home, and the audio was ruined.
It was like almost 2 hours, and we lost the entire thing.
You just can't go back after that. It just killed my soul. It was such a good episode. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of respect for them as an author. So I'm trying to think of... What do you want to go from next?
Well, we talked about sort of Hank's arc and you know sort of how he's trying to buy his house back and make good with his ex-wife in some way by hurting her new fiance, which of course is not the right way to go about it.
Well, his idea is that he's protecting her, but of course that's his way of insinuating himself into her life, which is
I appreciate how committed he is to staying dry.
Yeah.
There aren't a lot of scenes where he's like holding a shot glass, like ready to dive off.
One episode where it's the day Gretchen's getting married, and it's a really shitty day for him, as you can imagine. And he decides to gatecrash the wedding for a minute, which goes really, really bad. And then by sheer coincidence at that same hotel, something involving the conspiracy is going down, and that's a big distraction. That's pretty contrived, but whatever.
The conspiracy is pretty interesting if you bother to follow it.
Yeah.
Because so much of the show is devoted to the relationships, you might lose the thread after a while. Mm-hmm. Because it involves essentially the lone gunman at one point.
They do have their own little group of nerd hackers who are fun. But I'm sure if the show had gone on, we would have gotten to know him better.
We forgot to mention Hank's sister.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Played by Donald Logue's real sister.
Yeah. Let's see. Let me look up that character.
Yeah. You can do it.
It's here in front of me.
Steph, played by Karina Logue.
Karina Logue.
Initially, it seems like he has like maybe a rat or a raccoon living in his floorboards, and then it turns out his sister
has been squatting in the attic.
Yeah, she's got a history of severe mental health issues, and she was in an institution, and she broke out, and she has been hiding in his house for days, and he didn't know she was there. And he's very responsible. The first thing he does, hides everything sharp. Yeah. Just like, and he's continuing the plot. He's talking about plot points, and he's removing everything that could possibly be sharp. Mm. He's been through here before. He loves his sister very much, and he's trying to protect her. That's Hank in a nutshell. He's trying to protect everybody to a fault.
And there's no like diagnosis. We don't learn.
Not really.
Like,
no.
What's like what she's been diagnosed with, or why she was.
Eventually, we see that she is definitely has trouble distinguishing reality from fantasy.
Yeah,
which
and
narrows down a bit, but no doubt
she actually gets pretty much a whole episode.
Yeah.
Where she's constantly looking out the window at the house across the street, and goes across the street, and goes inside, and plays with a young girl who lives there. And then we realize later in the episode that that was all
in her head.
All a fantasy. Yeah. She goes back and she realizes, wait, this is all different.
Yeah.
Everything's changed. Where's the little girl that was living here? And that's when she kind of has a little bit of a moment where she realizes she needs help again.
Yeah.
And she goes back into the mental institution.
Yeah.
I like her, though, because she's not defined by that mental illness.
No, in fact, she's defined by her fierce intelligence.
Yeah, well, and also her, like, really flip sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
It's like she just calls the shots and very kind frank. Of calls people out, and, you know, she's actually a very likable character.
Yeah, and it's she's not there to just be a sidekick or be a thorn in Hank's side or be funny. She actually... Because she like
or went just to cheap drama.
Well, because she actually went to college and studied a lot of things, and as a result, she actually has some help to do with the plot. Because the overarching conspiracy, opens with first episode. Hank and Britt are investigating the disappearance of one of Hank's old friend's daughters.
Mm.
She's missing, and it turns out she may be missing because she was dating a local politician or a local rich entrepreneur, and. She might have taken something that is in evidence that could be proved something wrongdoing. Yeah. They find her. Turns out the evidence was a sex tape in which accidentally included the guy admitting criminal wrongdoing. Mm-hmm. And then they manage to squirrel her away, get her out of there, send her down to Mexico. But when they finally get back, it turns out that the dad has been murdered.
Yeah.
And so what they do in order to get back at the guy who did all this and who even went so far as to hire them to resolve the issue to his satisfaction, is they take the murder weapon and they hide it in his house and they frame him for murder. And their justification is, he probably did it. Which is pretty fucked up, but he's clearly a bad person. Yeah. So it's hard to get too mad, and it's definitely one of those film noir, you know, nobody's really a good person kind of things.
All of this eventually connects to this really... and this is where we start tipping into Chinatown territory.
Oh, it's absolutely Chinatown, yeah.
Because, yeah, it's like Southern California and the politics of resource management.
Yeah.
So there's this soil study that's been floating around, and people are after the soil study...
Because it proves the soil is basically poison. Well,
there's two different studies. One says that it's poison, one says that's not. Well, initially, I'm not really sure which is which.
Initially, the big reveal is that this big land development deal is on, what do you call it? Like a plot of land that is full of chemicals that would give everyone cancer.
Mm.
So they can't build anything there. But then it turns out that that was actually part of the scheme all along. They just didn't want to reveal it when they did. And actually part of the scheme was they were trying to scare people off of all that land so they could buy it all up, then reveal, oh, actually the soil studies are fine. And the big reveal towards the end is they were going to use it to build an airport that was going to be a huge cash grab for San Diego. All of a sudden there's competition for LAX.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit? The bad guy just wanted to bulldoze all of the cartoons in the movie. It's like, I'm going to murder all the cartoons, and we're just going to build the first freeway, because the movie takes place in 1947.
My God, it'll be beautiful. Yeah.
Quick, easy, fast. Traffic jams will be a thing of the past.
Lies! It's a beautiful motivation for a villain, especially in retrospect when you realize that the freeways... I mean, it's a good idea, but they do not work in LA. Yeah. The LA freeways are so fucked. They're so fucked up.
Yeah, and eventually, we get like more and more people like higher and higher up within the political system who are part of this conspiracy, who are murdering people to do this sort of like eminent domain type of land grab so they can actually build this airport.
It's incredibly complicated, and I think the show does a really good job of spacing out the main plot points so that it's not just this huge exposition dump. It's like when you're watching the Pelican Brief and they just stop the movie dead to explain everything that's in the Pelican Brief, and it's just sort of like, all right. right?
We didn't really need all of that.
Yeah. You want to just give us the important stuff and everything else when it becomes necessary, but just give us the important stuff. They're building an airport. It's fine.
And all of this comes in with a really fun supporting character who is like this journalist character.
Oh, yeah.
The investigative reporter character.
Yeah, very Lois Lane type.
Yeah.
Who comes in towards the end.
I think that might be Laura. I'm looking at the cast here. It might be Laura Ross, played by Allison Elliott.
Yes.
She and Hank end up like crossing paths and they have a similar case, and we felt her like without Hank's knowledge for a bulk of one episode. Yeah. And at the end, it's like, hey, I'm protecting you because I know you're on the right track.
Oh, there's
this really great bit where he's like spiriting her away from danger. He's found out that she's on the, like, who she is, what she's up to in this hotel, and like is able to conspire with her on the fly.
Yeah. Well, what he's doing is, so there's this lawyer who's responsible for everything. His name is Ben Zeitlin, and he's played by Michael Gaston. And he's the front man for this entire criminal conspiracy organization. And when he sees he's at this hotel, it's the day his wife's getting married, he decides to follow him, and it turns out he's giving an interview to this reporter. And with his lone gunman hacker crew, he bugs the room. Mm. And as he's bugging the room, and he's just listening to their conversation, he realizes that this reporter is getting very, very close to the truth of the conspiracy, and this lawyer is about to threaten her and her mother. And she doesn't know that anyone's listening in, so he's got to find a way to give her a message to say, A, you're in danger, he's serious. Mm. B, I am sending someone to pick up your mother so she's safe, so don't give in to his demands. Right. And that's even though that's the contrived episode where this just happens to be taking place at the hotel where his wife's getting married, that's a really good suspenseful bit. It feels like that scene is right out of Sneakers.
Yeah.
That scene is really great. Oh, by the way, if you were wondering what that humming noise is, we have to record in Whitney's apartment tonight for reasons.
That's and my refrigerator. His refrigerator is
80 years old and decides to just go, rah.
Come on, it's only 78. And
sorry, you don't look a day over 60.
It's quite an old refrigerator.
Yeah, sorry. It goes vroom.
It's a little loud. At least it doesn't make like a rattling noise.
If you can hear that, that's why. I mean, if we sound a smidge different, that's why.
But I like that character because we have sort of like a balance for Hank where he's a little bit more rough hewn and she's a little bit more, you described her like Lois Lane. She's a little bit more professional. And what I like is that we have opposite types of characters who aren't antagonistic. I feel like that's a really cheap way to wring drama.
It's obvious.
And any situation.
Yeah, I saw His Girl Friday. If people bicker, it's good, right? No, not necessarily. No, they can be funny without being mad at each other constantly.
I like the types of characters who are opposites and complement each other rather than are constantly sniping at each other. Because I don't want to see scene after scene of people just yelling. That's not interesting.
Scully and Mulder don't hate each other.
No, and
they just have a very different world views, but they work together very well.
And they even argue, but they're not always like insulting each other.
Well, it's like, if anything bad happened to you, like I would save you. We care about each other. It's just, I think you're wrong about aliens.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. I know a lot of people like, hey, buddy, I think you're wrong about the movie Dune. I'd still take a bullet for you. Like, we're not going to make that our thing.
A friend of mine, actually, he approached me once. He's like, hey, are we cool? It's like, yeah, we're cool. What's going on? It's like, well, just I really like Mortal Kombat Annihilation, and I know you hate it. It's like, well, okay, sometimes you have shitty taste in movies, but I still like you as a person.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think less of you because you like Mortal Kombat Annihilation.
Which is so sad that when you think about, like, what are modern relationships in the 21st century? 22nd century. We're in the 21st century? It's the 21st century.
Well, I want to be in the 22nd century. That sounds great.
We're in the 21st century now, and it feels like, we're in our 40s, and we're talking about, like, what if this was about some of our actual serious relationships in real life? What if you don't like Mortal Kombat and the other person gets mad at you for it? No. What the fuck became of us?
Social media has destroyed everything.
This is our lives. But this is a good show about people who actually really give a shit about each other.
Yeah.
And they can bicker and they can have fun, but it all comes from a place of warmth and friendship and love. And I can see why this show, in addition to just being pretty clever overall, the occasional plot maybe rings a little more true than others, but the characters and their dynamic and the affection they have for one another makes you want to revisit them. I can see why people would want this show to come back.
Yeah, there was one episode with a teenage boy with amnesia.
Oh, that was forced. That went off the rails.
That was a really bad episode.
It starts off with there's just this kid in a diner, and he's kind of making a mess of things, and it turns out he took some drugs, and he can't remember who he is. Mm. And they're trying to figure out who this guy is, because he thinks he did something wrong. And that flies completely off. It ends with, like, drug runners breaking into Britt's house, kidnapping his girlfriend and the guy she slept with. And it's, I seriously, by the time that happened, I just had to, like, put the show down for a minute. I'm like, I have no idea how we got here. Like, I don't know if it feels like I missed a scene. Like, this is really an episode out of
the Bone Collector series that we saw. Where it's something really kind of lascivious and pulpy. There's that plot also involves, like, he's taking drugs and losing his memory and he doesn't know who he is, and he might have committed a horrible crime. And there's also a supporting character of a transgender sex worker who is actually a big part of that episode. And they actually, like, delve into that character's personal life a lot.
I wish that character had gotten more to do, because the whole idea is Donald Logue Britt is asked to, this guy says, hey, my college age cousin or brother or whatever engaged the services of a sex worker who took the money and didn't give him any of his services. Could you help him get his money back? And he finds the sex worker, and it turns out that she is trans. And she realized in the middle of the transaction, while the sex was about to start going on, that this kid didn't realize that. Rather than put him in a situation that might make him really uncomfortable, she decided to split. She probably should have given him back the money. She admits that. She gives him back the money. That's pretty much taken care of.
Just be a little bit more upfront about it. She was worried.
And
this guy was also very young. He's like 18 or 19.
And also think about
it. Clearly very inexperienced.
And also think about it. You're a trans sex worker, and you might surprise someone with that. I'm sure there's a lot of jobs who behave very, very badly to that. So I totally understand why they left. So she gives the dude his money back, and then she engages Britt's services again to track down another trans sex worker who has gone missing. That all handles reasonably well.
Reasonably well. I think everybody is totally cool with it, and there's not, like...
Well, except for the shitty parents who gave up on that kid who got missing.
But the point is they're shitty. But I think Britt deals with those two characters the most, and Britt's actually a very sensitive guy. He's really kind of a puppy dog.
I appreciate that there's not one moment of gay panic from Britt.
Yeah.
Where he's like, what? He's just like, oh, okay.
That's a thing.
Okay, cool. Go on. How does this engage with the plot?
One episode, though, is like really...
That's a lot. That's a lot of television.
Doesn't click into the rest of the
That is a lot of television in one episode, man. That one was weird. The one episode that I actually really liked is like a standalone, even though I actually think it's a little darker than it needs to be, and it kind of hurts Donald Logue's character a little bit. There's this episode where he's trying to get a loan to put a down payment on the house. And this one bank or lending service says they won't, except the guy who runs the place finds out that this guy, who's discredited as shit, as you can imagine, finds out that he's a private detective. And he says, I'll make you a deal. I think my wife is cheating on me. If you can prove it, I will.
This is
interesting because as an
individual
episode, as just an individual detective story, you could pluck this out of Terriers and it would be like a really solid Dean Cain kind of, not Dean Cain.
Dean Cain, the actor?
No, not Dean Cain. who wrote Double Indemnity?
Oh, who wrote Double Indemnity?
Something Cain.
Herman Cain.
No, what? John Cain? What did I?
Double
How
Indemnity.
Did I do this?
I don't know, but it's not Dean Cain, and it's not.
It's not Dean Cain. That's for goddamn sure. It's something Cain.
James M. Cain.
James M. Cain. Right. Wow, it is late. I've had a long day.
I didn't know that. I couldn't have pulled that out.
I should have known that. He wrote The Thin Man. He's a brilliant writer. But this would have worked well as like a done in one like short story. But in any case, so he's hired to prove that this guy's wife, played by the great Olivia Williams from Rushmore. That she's cheating on him, and he follows her around, and she going off on her own a lot, like having dinner by herself and like some other things that are just kind of odd,
suspicious.
A little odd. I can see why you're suspicious, but she's not actually doing anything. So he says, good news. I found out she's not cheating on you. And the guy's like, you're fired and you're not going to get the money you're going to lend you. He's like, why? I heard you to prove my wife is cheating on me. And the guy's like, good news. She's not. It's like, That's not what I want. I know she's cheating on me. She's said she's cheating on me. So either you're a shitty private detective or you're calling my wife a liar. So he finally gives up and confronts her directly. And it turns out that the guy who runs this bank or whatever.
He's into that.
That's his fantasy. He's into what... I forget what... I don't know what the exact terminology would be, like sexual humiliation, cuckold fantasy.
Cuckolding. Just...
I want to use the positive way about it, because there's nothing wrong with it if it's consensual. But,
well, I mean, cuckolding was perfectly legit until recently.
Until it turned into, like, this huge, like, this weird
cultural signifier. But, yeah,
but, like, the idea is basically he's turned on by her sleeping with other people. It makes him feel good in an unusual way. In a way that certainly Donald Logue doesn't understand. And his wife loves him, but is not really into it. And so she has been saying she's been cheating on him, but she's actually just been going off and, like, seeing a movie or getting a hotel room so that it shows up on the credit card, but she's not actually doing anything. And she does this because she loves him. And eventually he's just got to prove that he's actually doing it. And so in order to do that, they have to basically
stage a cheating scenario
with Britt, no less. And the episode ends really tragically. So he's just, and because, he says, okay, so here's the evidence. And then the guy is like, yeah, no, my wife told me everything, and I know this is all staged, and I'm still really fucking mad at you.
Well, damn it.
And then after all of that, Olivia Williams comes to Donald Logue, and they've had some chemistry. They decide to sleep together. I assume it's nice. And then in the morning, he goes to the guy, and he says, I can prove that I did sleep with your wife, because... I grew voice cheating on you because I slept with your wife. And I can describe a mole she has on her back and stuff like that.
And he gets, like, really crass about it.
Yeah,
he gets really crass.
And then the guy's like, okay, fine. Here's your money. Cool. And then Donald Logue leaves the room, and the guy jumps out the window and kills himself.
Jeez.
Which is the sexual politics of that, in terms of, like, sort of kink shaming and sort of, like, this weird judgment of this guy for what he's into, really could have been explored better. And I ultimately feel in the end that the idea that Donald Logue's character was... at the very least handled that situation badly, is kind of unexplored, and he kind of just gets off. Like, Olivia Williams finds out and she's furious, but that's kind of it. And it's one of those things where this horrible thing that really most people just from proximity to this would need therapy to deal with their, you know, the fact that I was involved in this incident and this guy killed himself and maybe I would blame myself for that. A lot of people would need some therapy to get through that. This is TV, so that kind of horrifying, life-changing scenario happened last week, and as a result, we can forget all about it next week. Next week, we can kidnap a dog. Like, it's just sort of like, wow, we moved on from that fast. Yeah. It's like an interesting, morally complicated story in itself.
They could have continued that for several episodes, or even the rest of the season.
That could have just been its own thing. That could have just been the story of a private detective who did this, was involved in this thing, and it's morally complicated, doesn't know how to feel about himself in the end, and that could have been that. But when you just have to move on with the plot the next week, and the banter continues, it ultimately makes Logue's character feel way more callous than it should. And I think it's actually kind of a... even though it's like a solid done-in-one episode, it's a bit of a misstep for the series as a whole.
I'm guessing because one of the big subplots is an infidelity subplot.
Sure.
It's like contrived soap opera dynamics.
But that's,
you know,
TV for
that's a big part of it. And here's another episode that's also about infidelity and sort of the emotional damage it leaves behind. This is a show that doesn't think very highly of that kink, I'm guessing.
I suppose it does suggest, maybe, and I wish they could draw a clearer line, this might be one of the reasons why Donald Logue tells Britt's... girlfriend, don't tell.
Yeah.
Because that guy found out.
Yeah.
And it did not help him.
That's true.
They had made that clearer in some way, that there was like, that's what he was thinking of.
I saw this happen and it didn't work out for this one guy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, that might have actually really, really worked. And it would have, because again, you can say to yourself, okay, maybe that is the right thing to do, is to tell her not to tell her boyfriend. I would disagree. But it would go a long way to justifying why he would make that particular choice. And it's all there in the text. I just don't feel like they connected the dots very well.
It's the first season
of a show. There's some missteps, I feel. But overall, the characters are wonderful.
Well,
the plotting is really good for the most part.
This one was, one of the showrunners was Tim Minear, who worked on Firefly. And we talked a great deal about Firefly. We did a whole separate podcast about Firefly. And the sexual politics of that show
are
pretty fucked.
Yeah. A lot of that's Joss Whedon, though. And we have to realize that Tim Minear also did a show that we really, really liked called Drive, which did not have nearly as many problems.
That's true. Yeah. But there's not a lot of sex in Drive.
No. There's the plot's much more in your face. This cross-country race, time is of the essence. But
yeah, so most people are just sort of like stealing cars and stuff.
I think if a sexist writer, if they really wanted to, could have found space for it. Now, I'm not saying that a sexist writer might have not been able to fit it all in. I'm not saying that necessarily means he's not capable of that. But I do think that there was definitely room could have been made in Drive for really sleazy sexist bullshit if they really, really wanted to.
I feel like a sexist writer would work overtime to work in that sexism.
I realize how that sounds, but I'm just saying is that there are plenty of shows that are way more about incident and plot that are sexist, and there are plenty of shows that are about incident and plot that aren't as sexist.
Okay.
And I'm not trying to exonerate anybody. I'm just saying it just feels like, well, one is and one isn't, you know? So at the very least, there's hope, I guess. That's all I can say.
I wanted to go through, I was just looking over the credits. This show had some pretty amazing directors.
Oh, yeah.
Episode by episode. The pilot was directed by Craig Brewer, who did Hustle and Flow and Black Snake Moan. Most recently, Dolomite Is My Name and Coming Number 2 America.
Yeah, didn't he do the remake of Footloose as well? Was that him? Or am I thinking of someone else?
Is that Craig Brewer?
I think it was one of the Craigs.
Yeah, he did. He did the remake of Footloose.
Very good director.
I didn't see the Footloose
remake. It's not bad. It's not. You would think it would be just kind of pointless, and I guess we didn't need it, but it's pretty good, actually.
Yeah, Dolomite Is My Name is so good.
That's an amazing film. Hustle and Flow is really, really great. He's a good director.
We have a director named Ryan Johnson,
He'll go far.
He'll go places from 2010.
Yeah, well, he'd already done Brick and stuff, so he only got bigger and bigger.
Yeah, and now he's probably best known for a Star Wars picture.
Although, ironically, the thing that actually ended up shooting his career into high gear was his Knives Out.
Yeah,
just turning into like a Netflix franchise for like an astounding amount of money. So good for him.
We had John Dahl, who directed an indie film called Red Rock West. He did The Last Seduction.
Yep, very good. Mars
Rounders. He did a film called Joyride with Paul Walker.
Very, very, very good. Underappreciated, I feel. Most people don't really talk about him and his oeuvre.
Mm.
It's one hit after another, basically, or at the very least, acclaimed film.
And we had a sparkling star of Halloween H2O, Adam Arkin.
Oh, yeah.
Son of Alan Arkin.
Co-star of Pig. Mm-hmm. Very good Pig.
Mostly known for his acting, but also directed. And he directed, I think, 2 or 3 episodes.
Yeah.
Good for... Look up Adam Arkin. He's had a really weird career. I looked up a film of his called... It was called Full Moon High.
Oh, yeah.
Which he was in like the early 80s, where Ed McMahon played his dad and they went on vacation and he became a werewolf. And it was clearly a knockoff of I Was a Teenage Werewolf, but before Teen Wolf came out.
Weird.
It beat Teen Wolf to the punch.
Well, because there had been that sort of like I Was a Teenage Vampire. David Hasselhoff in one of those?
David Hasselhoff.
Wasn't David Hasselhoff in like an early teen monster movie?
Oh, I don't know.
Maybe I'm thinking of someone else. I will look that up. That feels like the sort of thing
you might
I
be thinking
know.
Of Michael Landon, who
I'm thinking of Michael
who
Landon.
Was the teenage werewolf.
I'm thinking of Michael Landon. I'm thinking of Michael Landon. That's exactly it. For me, they always looked a little bit.
But yeah, I got to write about Full Moon High because it was an early notable role for the late great Bob Saget.
Ah, yes.
Who was like in 3 scenes playing 3 different characters. Adam Arkin directed a couple, and Ted Griffin, the show's creator, directed a couple as well.
Yeah. Terriers concludes. I mean, obviously, not everything is wrapped up, but by the end of the series,
it leaves us on a cliffhanger.
It leaves us on a bit of a cliffhanger. But basically, what it boils down to is this: Britt didn't handle the whole my girlfriend / fiance cheated on me thing very well, and he thought she had slept with one of her fellow students. And beat the shit out of him.
Like, waited for him outside of a bar, approached him, and just beat him up.
Yeah, and so he was arrested and ultimately convicted of assault and battery. So he's going to go to jail at the end. Meanwhile, they've wrapped up more or less the whole conspiracy plot. Certainly, it seems like this exact scheme has been messed
and
up.
And we know we met the bad guy because he was played by Neil McDonough.
Yeah, I was going to get to this. you have to reveal that there's like someone above, like the lawyer, someone above, like the entrepreneur, someone who's been pulling these strings all along. And in 2 scenes, you don't get a lot of real estate. Pardon the pun. to introduce this character. So casting is going to play a big role. You want someone who is not only recognizable, but is recognizably kind of villainous. You know, if you've got somebody
who plays a lot of heavy.
Like if you'd gotten Bob Saget, it wouldn't have played. You need to someone who's like...
Maybe like Clancy Brown.
Clancy Brown would have been good. That perfect example right there. And who they got was Neil McDonough. Neil McDonough has done some heroic type roles. He played, he was in the Captain America, First Avenger. He was in Minority Report as one of the good cops.
Yeah, he was one of his early roles was the remake of Angels in the Outfield. Yeah. And I think he played just sort of like a baseball player.
Yeah, I don't remember that very well.
He played
Lieutenant Hawk
in Star Trek First Contact.
Ah, yes. The red shirt, basically, in that movie.
He was the red shirt in that movie.
Yeah, he was like built up just enough so that when he died, he'd be like, oh no, Hawk. It's such good. We had so many adventures.
And he was in Ravenous too. Little connection
there.
Right.
But in any case, he built up himself up like a bit of a cottage industry over the last 20 years, playing a lot of bad guys. Mm-hmm. He was M. Bison in that Chun-Li movie with Kristen Kreuk.
Oh, was he really? I didn't see
that.
Yeah,
he played M. Bison. Oh, it was hilarious. And he had like a really. The only thing I remember about that movie is he had a really sweet bromance with Balrog, played by I think Michael Clark Duncan. Like they were really close friends.
Oh, that's really cute.
That was like, the only thing I remember about it
for years, because I first read the name M. Bison off of the Street Fighter 2 screen. I played the arcade game when it came out. I thought he was Monsieur Bison.
Oh,
M. Bison, and so I called him Monsieur Bison for the longest time.
Well, you know why the main bad guy in Street Fighter 2 is named M. Bison, right?
Well, I know now that they actually accidentally jumbled some of the character names when they brought it over to the United States.
Yeah, the villains in the game, like the main boss fights, who initially were unplayable characters. Now, of course, you can play them, but
there's Balrog, Vega, and M. Bison,
and Sagat,
and Sagat.
Balrog, Vega, and M. Bison were accidentally switched. Their names were all switched together. Sagat was always Sagat.
So the main bad guy was supposed to be Vega.
Yeah, which is more of like a generic main bad guy name, a little more enigmatic. And then the Matador character was going to be Balrog. And the...
Oh, no, he's... It's like a masked guy with claws.
Yeah, the idea is he's like a matador. He's wearing, like, matador, like, a uniform, and he's in, like, a kind of a cage, and he's throwing roses. And then
a boxer.
And then the boxer character, who looks a lot like Mike Tyson, was supposed to be called Mike Bison. And...
Or M. Bison.
Or M.
Sure.
They call him M. Bison, but clearly he's supposed to think Mike Bison.
Mike Bison.
So just when it came to America, there was a little bit of a snafu. Nobody really noticed or cared. And the main bad guy was now called M. Bison. Why? Because it's a fuck up.
And the boxer is Balrog.
And now we're stuck with it.
And the Matador is Vega.
And now we're just stuck with it. We just don't question it anymore.
For years, I thought it was Monsieur Bison.
Yeah. Like, seriously, like, you watch that, like, Street Fighter movie Neil McDonough is in. There's, like, this weird scene where he helps someone give birth in a cave, but it's all evil. And it's like, it makes no fucking sense. He's
played high and low. He's been in a big low budget thing. He's been in big budget things.
My favorite two part like double feature with Neil McDonough, because they're both really bad movies. There is Paul Blart Mall Cop 2, which stars Neil McDonough as a bad guy who holds an entire hotel hostage, a la Die Hard. Mm. And then there's the movie.
Good role for him.
He's well cast. It's a bad movie, but he's well cast. And then, like a couple years later, he was in a Netflix comedy called Game Over, in which he played a bad guy who took an entire hotel hostage, like in Die Hard. And they're both comedies.
Oh, dear.
It's the same goddamn role. I wouldn't be surprised if he was playing the same character.
I would like to talk to Neil McDonough. Were you playing the same character? Were you twins?
Did you notice that this was exactly what you did in Paul Blart 2? Mm. Did you think, and did your agent say no one's going to notice? Because I hate to break it to you, I did. I realize I sound harsher than I mean to, Neil McDonough. I'm sure you're a nice guy.
he seems like a perfectly decent guy.
I'm sure he's a decent guy.
I admire him as an actor. Sure. I admire his professionalism.
He's a very talented actor. You know, I've never seen him like blow me away in anything, but he's always doing his job.
He was in, and I only learned this recently, a lot of people have been making a lot of hay out of Bruce Willis' career recently. How Bruce Willis has been taking just job after job of these like
low budget
garbage low budget genre movies, and they are pretty unilaterally bad from what I understand. I haven't seen one of them, but you know, if you go to Redbox, you're gonna see a lot of Bruce Willis, and Neil McDonough plays the bad guy in one of those. And I saw some clips of it where he's like a hunter who like keeps severed human heads,
But Bruce Willis, like, or Neil McDonough?
Neil McDonough.
Okay.
And he has this, like, special, like, transporter room where he sticks the head in and it vanishes and, like, appears in on his trophy case. Like, the science fiction device. And I think they did that because the trophy case is covered. Like, they're all behind doors. So we don't actually see the severed heads. And you can tell that this, like, science fiction device was clearly just, like, somebody's closet. You can see where they removed the door, like, the dents of the hinges. And they just have, like, this green light coming up from behind. And he sticks his hand in. And there's some smoke. And there's an edit. It's, like, the cheapest thing. Like,
that's
something
amazing.
Something you would have made in high school. That's amazing. This is, like, an actual professional movie.
That's so great.
I kind of admire that Neil McDonough will still do that.
It's a job.
And he's professional, too. He's like... Okay, science.
Well, I admire any actor who can balance that. You know, like, I'm a professional, hardworking actor. I will star in an entire season of this hit TV series, Legends of Tomorrow, and I will play this iconic character from the comics. But I'll also do a straight-to-video Bruce Willis movie because I had a week free in February. You know, like, I admire working ethic actors, people who just do the gig. You can't not, honestly.
He's played a bunch of superheroes, too. He played Green Arrow. He played Deadshot.
He was in Green Arrow.
No, he played Green Arrow.
I think he played Green Arrow. That was like an alternate reality episode or something.
He was in a TV show called DC Showcase, Green Arrow.
Oh,
And he played Green Arrow.
I don't know what that. I don't know what that is. He played one of Green Arrow's biggest villains in like season 4 of Green Arrow.
Oh, there you go.
So that's why I think that might be some kind of alternate reality episode or something.
He played Bruce Banner in the '90s Incredible Hulk animated series.
Oh, that's fun.
He's been around. So when he shows up, it's always kind of delightful. You recognize him. He has piercing blue eyes and blonde hair.
And the second you see him, it's like, oh, he's the bad guy. Cool. Yeah. And he underplays it, which I like. Like, he doesn't consider himself a bad guy. You know, he's like, he's distanced himself so much from all of the actual evil that's been done on the show. I wouldn't be surprised if he's unaware of half of it.
No.
But he also doesn't seem to lose any sleep at night. So that's a nice little bit of storytelling. The end of the show is everything's more or less wrapped up. Gretchen's husband has been killed in this conspiracy, which resolves that plot, but is also like, wow, she's been through a lot.
It's pretty aft, actually.
Yeah, it's pretty messed up. And so does, so that's rough. So that's what happens there. And at the episode ends, the final episode ends with, Donald Logue and, Donald, what's his name
in the character?
Hank.
Hank Dolores.
Yeah. Hank and Britt. Are in a car, and it's a little like the ending of The 25th Hour, where it's basically like, okay, if
you're
about
to go to prison,
if we turn left,
we go to Mexico.
We go to Mexico, and I will do that with you, and we will totally just live off the grid, and that will be our life. Or you go to prison for like 18 months.
It's like 3 years.
It's like 3 years. Yeah. It probably like gets on off good behavior, but he's going to prison regardless. Yeah. And it's serious prison. And that's the end. Or what choice are they going to make?
They cut before he makes a decision. And presumably season 2 would be about...
The decision.
Whatever the decision
And I'm
was.
Sure they'd be coy about it for like 15 minutes or something before they actually revealed what they did. Like that second season of Felicity where you're not sure who she ended up with.
What ending did he want? Like if
okay, I'm
going
to... There's
season.
Two answers to that question.
All right.
There's two answers to that question. What I want for the characters... is for Britt to go to prison, get time off for good behavior, or maybe figure out some sort of scam that's happening in there, and they let him go because he figured out there's some like corruption in the prison, and it's all and that's a good 2-part episode or something like that, and it resolves that. What I kind of want for the show is for them to be in Mexico and do everything they're doing
in Mexico.
And do everything they're doing on the lam.
Okay.
Do everything like everything that they're doing, but they're
kind of
in, like,
a little bit of an A team spin.
A little bit, but like it's not like
freelance rogues.
But they're not in San Diego. I want them to just be living in Mexico and solving crimes in I don't know where they are, Tijuana or wherever they are, but also knowing that they have made choices that have limited their options, and that could actually be a really cool season of television. I think both would be fine, but I think the critic in me wants them to go to Mexico, and I think the person who loves the characters wants them to go to prison and deal with his responsibilities.
I think if I were a television writer, I would want them to go to Mexico because I would.
Oh, okay.
Because there's a lot of story possibilities there and a lot of character possibilities there. It's also really contrived, and it's the easy way out. I think having him go to prison and do the moral thing is going to be quite frankly, the more interesting and also more difficult to write story.
I think you're going to need like a solid half season of Hank out of prison and Britt in prison, and you're sort of cross-cutting between their storylines. Because you definitely don't... Here's what you definitely don't want. You definitely don't want to cut to Britt getting out of prison. That would be... I think that would be a cheat. I do.
Like skip forward like a year and a half.
A year and a half, 3 years later, whatever. Britt's out of prison and he's changed or whatever like that. I don't want that. I don't want to have... It's the first season. I don't want to have that big a break in the characters. Okay. I would maybe if you were season 5 and you wanted to, like, going into season 6, we'll do a big time jump in order to sort of reset the clock or something like that.
Oh, what show did they do that in? It was Burn Notice. The Gabrielle Anwar character was arrested at one point, and a large part of the next season, she was just in prison.
Oh, there you go.
Something I appreciated is her character... you know, she's always... You know, helping out the who's the lead of that show?
The guy
Jeffrey Donovan. Like she's helping him out, and they are they used to date, so there's this kind of like antagonistic will they or won't they? Maybe they're regrowing their romance sort of thing, and they both look like $1 million because they're in Miami and they're always doing their hair up and they're both doing their makeup. And when she goes into prison, they were very careful to let Gabrielle Anwar grow her original eyebrows back.
Oh.
So her eyebrows are a lot thicker when she's in prison.
Okay.
You can tell for the show. It's just, like they made her pluck her eyebrows.
Yeah. You don't get to go to a salon. Yeah.
Yeah. She's clearly not in there plucking her brows every day.
But I also know shows that did the time jump really well. One of them was the reboot of Battlestar Galactica. There was an ending of one season where, you know, they've been looking for Earth, this mythic place called Earth.
Right.
And then there's this one season where they think they might have found a place that isn't Earth, but might be good enough. Mm-hmm. And then we cut to a while later and see how that's worked out. It has worked out so badly. It's so fucking horrifying what happened. God, I love that show. I want to rewatch that now. I wish I had time. All right. Anyway, you need to watch that one of these days.
I was like, they're the smash cuts. There's a smash cut in... of all things, one of the SpongeBob movies, where the local burger, the entire economy of SpongeBob revolves around a single burger joint. Like that's the only thing,
which is just not sustainable.
It is in the world of SpongeBob. I mean,
apparently not.
Talking sea sponges and fishes and all the and what have you, but it closes down.
Exactly, it's not sustainable.
And they said, "Well, our burger joint is closed. How long before we become post-apocalyptic warriors?" And there's literally just a smash cut. Where nobody moves, they're just all of a sudden in like the post-apocalyptic like Road Warrior gear, and there's fires. It's underwater, but there's still fires.
Do not question SpongeBob.
SpongeBob is it's just lunacy. It's complete nonsense.
Yeah,
I kind of like those movies. I haven't seen the show, but I
only saw the first movie, but I liked it, and I've seen a few episodes of the show. It's the same
thing. I've seen all three of those movies, and then they're
fucking weird.
The second one is totally bizarre.
Yeah. Oh, because the other one's fine.
They're all really strange, but that second one especially. The third one has, you know, Keanu Reeves like as a live action head in a tumbleweed. Danny Trejo plays Satan.
Yeah. If Terriers had lasted 100 episodes, which it wouldn't because it's the FX model, they would probably give it like 6 or 7 seasons and then wrap it up on its own terms if they really could. Well,
6 or 7, that's 100 episodes.
Not for a 12 episode a season show.
Oh, I guess not.
Like that's that model really. It's like that sort of event programming. But regardless, you know, if it gotten its full run, I think one of the cool things about the show is that a lot, you could do almost anything with it, honestly. Like there's definitely things that would be out of character. You want to keep it working class. You want to keep it small. But again, you could do a season where they're in prison. You could do a season where they're in Mexico on the lam. Both of those things are equally plausible, and you could get to one if you don't get to the other one later. So there's a lot of possibilities.
Well, there's a lot of possibilities. What I admire about Terriers is it does do a lot of really predictable, recognizable soap opera stuff.
Sure.
But it does it well.
Mostly,
And so I'm willing to forgive a lot if it's doing the story well and the characters are doing it well and the actors are really selling it.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that means they would continue to do some of that stuff. I just know that there'd be an arc where Hank falls off the wagon.
Or Hank sleeps with Katie. Or he gets
back with the ex for a little bit and there's all of this like push and pull.
Britt has an identical twin.
Sure, why not? Oh, yeah, and it turns out I have a sister, but we also have a brother that I never talked about, you know, that kind of stuff.
Like, well, you never told me I had a brother. I have a half-brother. His name is Cybok.
Cybok, oh, God. You just know, like, their parents would start getting involved after a while. Yeah. It's like, and so I'm not
His dad would be played by Brian Dennehy.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, Donald Logue's Canadian and Irish, so who's like a good Canadian or Irish, like, dad type? Who could play that really well?
Brendan Gleeson.
I mean, yeah, he's well-known Irish actor. You know, you get Liam Neeson. There you go.
Oh, they're not going to get Liam Neeson. They're not going to get
Not in 2010.
No, not in 2010. There's no way.
He was still riding high off of Taken.
His career was having this huge resurgence. There's no way you get Liam Neeson. There's not. Maybe. Brian Cox. You could get Brian Cox. Hmm. Brian Cox, who is also the voice of McDonald's commercials now.
Is he really?
I can't get over.
After seeing L.I.E., that's got a little tough to take.
It's so fucking weird. It's just everyone's about, just hear Brian Cox like, burgers are good and stuff. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. And I'm like, what? The fuck? How successful is Succession? Holy shit.
I saw Brian Cox in an episode of Red Dwarf back in the day. Wow. And there was like a medieval episode. They beamed down to a medieval planet. I know they don't beam in that show. But yeah, they played outtakes over the credits. And there's like, he couldn't remember his lines. And take him and have cut off his head and peel off his skin and feed it to the dogs. And that was almost like a better reading than the sort of straight one he gave.
I love Brian Cox so damn much.
But back to the point.
Yeah, the point is Brian Cox.
Well, the point is, there would be a tendency for this to teeter over into contrivance. Because it was already sort of leaning that direction.
Yeah.
And I would hope that if they continued with another season, that they would be wise enough not to lean into the contrived areas.
That would be the fantasy, Well, in any case, it's time to make the call. Mm-hmm. I think I know what we're voting for. Do you think Terriers was canceled too soon?
I think it was. I think I want to see a little bit more. Even though I have a little bit of trepidation, I have faith in what I've seen. And I think Donald Logue's really strong. I think the characters are really strong.
Yeah.
I think it's a weirdly mature show.
It is,
for the kind of setup they gave us.
It seems like it's going to be like a goofy, bro-y, almost like a stoner kind of comedy. And no, it's actually quite intelligent. I think it's definitely, every once in a while, it pulls out a legitimately great private detective story. The overarching storyline, fine, not really where my interest is. The soap opera dynamics, sometimes they push it too hard, but ultimately I want to hang out with these characters every week. That's a lot. That's what you want from TV. And there's plenty of other adventures they could go on that would be really, really exciting. So yes, I agree. I think Terriers was canceled too soon. And that is it for this episode of Canceled Too Soon. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
Thank you for your patience, by the way. And
I know.
Waiting for me to see this.
We'll be back real soon with an episode that ties into one of our Patreon exclusives.
That's right.
At patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, we have a lot of exclusive shows, one of which has been going on for about a year. It's over a year now, right?
Oh, it's been a while.
Hey. We've been doing it for a while. It's been called Holy Batman. It's W-H-O-L-L-Y, entirely Batman. And we've been reviewing every single episode of the 1960s live-action Batman TV series, starring Adam West, Burt Ward, and a cavalcade of celebrity guests playing villains like Penguin and Catwoman and King Tut and the Riddler and so on. Well, we recently reached, as of like this week, the final episode of the live-action Batman, but Burt Ward and Adam West continued playing Batman and Robin in a few other pieces of media. And we're going to be covering most of those on our Patreon, but one of them was a one-season animated series from 1977 called The New Adventures of Batman, starring Adam West
and Burt Ward,
and their new sidekick, Batmite, which is basically like giving Batman the Great Gazoo.
Was Batmite introduced for this show? Because I know Batman was also a part of the comics.
Batmite.
I mean, we'll talk about this when we get to it.
Of course, he will. But I believe Batmite pre-existed the show.
Okay.
However, I will do more research and we will cover that in more detail very soon. But in any case, that's coming up next, and we're looking to have a very special guest, friend of the show and very close friend of me, my partner M. Lapis da Silva, who is one of our animation experts. They're going to be joining us for that episode to talk about all things Batman and all things 70s animation, and it's going to be really exciting and fun. And then we will continue to talk about more Batman in the Patreon-exclusive environment, but then we have a lot of really cool episodes lined up on our schedule for Cancel Too Soon. So please stick around. We've got some more cool stuff coming. Right now, the plan is to alternate Cancel Too Soon and Critically Reclaimed. We do one week, one the next week, and go back and so on.
That's the plan. We'll see how well we can adhere to that.
I think we can do it if we get used to Whitney's schedule. And again, this is all new.
Yeah,
we had a status quo for 2 years, and it changed dramatically in a week. And
just
we
started thought it this, was gonna, this new job, yeah. And I've had it for less than a month.
We thought we knew what that was going to be like, and then life threw us some curveballs, and we're like, okay, we need to reorganize. And so we're working on it, but that's where we're at. In any case, that's what's coming up next in Cancel Too Soon. We also have all of our other shows here, the Critically Acclaimed Network. We have a lot of other shows on our Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We're on Twitter, @CriticAcclaim. I'm @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
If you would like to discuss Terriers or anything else on the show, you feel free to email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Or you can write us a actual physical letter. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Send us a letter. It's P.O. box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
And if you send us a piece of correspondence, electronically or otherwise, we might read your email in an upcoming episode of our podcast, We've Got Mail. So feel free to take us to task if we were wrong about something, ask us a question about whatever, podcasting, film criticism, film, television, it's something random. What's our favorite gum? Whitney, what's your favorite gum?
What's my favorite gum?
I asked you.
I don't know.
Really?
I don't have a favorite gum.
You don't have a favorite gum?
You know what? I started when I was working as a projectionist,
which
required a lot of late hours,
yeah.
Especially when you're projecting like 2.5 hour movies starting at midnight.
Yeah.
You need a lot of caffeine.
Yeah. It gets
really I found sneaky. Something that they only sell at gas stations.
What's that?
Called Rev Gum. It's caffeinated chewing gum.
Nice.
And it's like slow release. It just like releases caffeine very slowly into your system rather than a big jolt like a cup of coffee. So
that's cool.
That was my favorite gum for a while. That nice. Gum was my friend for a little bit.
Nice.
I'm going to die. My heart is going to give out when I'm 50.
Well, I assume significantly safer, although I'm not 100% sure in the statistics, is caffeinated soap. We actually sell caffeinated soap, my partner and I. We have a soap store called Salt Cat Soap, which is on Etsy, etsy.com/shop/saltcatsoap. Or you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook @saltcatsoap. We'll have a link there. One of the products we sell is caffeinated soap. We call it our Vampire Hours soap because vampires are up very late. And it is caffeinated, and it makes your skin tingle, and it's really fun. We have a lot of other soaps there. We debut new soaps on the first of every month. We've got glow-in-the-dark ghost soaps. We've got our lesbian vampire soap, which smells like vampires allegedly smell like, according to the novel Carmilla. we have a lot of... And that's just our horror-themed stuff. We have a lot of like wonderful floral sets and ocean floor bars, which look like the ocean floor with the... salt standing in for sand and everything. Really cool. Anyway, all that is available at Salt Cat Soap. Thank you to everybody who's already bought some of the soap. Our reviews have been fantastic, and it really means a lot to us that people are not only buying the soaps, but enjoying them. So thank you for everyone for that.
And I'll hype a podcast I was on, another podcast. For the better part of the last 6 months, I and a wonderful podcaster who ran her own podcasting network called The Screen's Margins did a podcast called All About Ovid. It's all about Ovid.
OLLOBOUT OVID.
Ovid is a streaming service, and they do a lot of deep cut art house stuff and a lot of international cinema. The films that you heard about that were playing in museums are on this service. And B and I would watch something on that service, and we'd talk about it at first on a weekly basis, then we moved to monthly. It is now on indefinite hiatus. It is pretty much shut down for the time being. B is taking care of some personal stuff. But our last episode just went up kind of recently, where we talked about Academy Award nominated animated short films.
Nice, well done.
There's a collection of those on Ovid.
Very cool.
I recommend Ovid just in general, but yeah. I also recommend B and my conversations about those things because B has a lot of interesting insights.
Yeah,
she's a very interesting person.
Very cool. And seriously, check that out. Wonderful work. Anyway, that's it for Cancel Too Soon. We'll see you next time with the new adventures of Batman from 1977. And of course, we have a lot of other shows here, Critically Acclaimed, and our Patreon in the meanwhile. That's a wrap. We will see you next season.